Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. And before I get to the gist of this program, I'd like to say happy birthday to William Michael Schuster. He's an old friend of 40 years, and now he's my upstairs neighbor. He's an artist, a raconteur, a former Marine and Vietnam veteran, and also, and this is how I met him, a member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So happy birthday, Michael, or Will, as many people know him. Well, as you probably know, having listened to this station, if indeed you have, and if indeed you are, this weekend is Fisher Poets' annual reading. I believe it's the 13th. Yes, lucky 13. And I'd like to sort of devote the program to that. And I'd like to begin with something I wrote, which I seem to read almost every year here on this program at the advent of Fisher Poet Weekend, The Price of Fish. And I guess I should give the disclaimer that this might be opinion, my opinion and my opinion only in the entire cosmos, watery or spatial. The Price of Fish. A boat or a ship is much like a star, moving across the oceans in the same manner as a star through space and time. Its motion seems less from its own volition than the movement of the planet sliding beneath its keel. Points appear or disappear, approach or fade into horizontal haze. Days and nights pass and vanish as quickly as a ship's wake or a gull's cry. They have no meaning, simply a succession of minor cycles like the rise and fall of tides upon a shore, memorable only because a few suns passed, a whale might have been sighted, or a storm made a voyage miserable and dangerous for a while. A feeling grows, not unlike the ambiguous emptiness sought by Oriental religions, a sense of aimlessness, yet also of great wealth, though nothing is possessed. The movement of the ocean in tandem with the wind follows the rhythms of music, and life aboard a deck is a form of dance. The immensity of ocean is difficult to place into human reference, though we chart it and make neighborhoods of navigation points, plat its surface into abstract grids. These are only thin trails through a vast prairie. It is impossible to not recognize its alienness to us, its antithesis to everything we find familiar and sustaining to our lives of shore. We nestle to the land like gophers in a burrow and feel that it cares for us. Nothing about the ocean gives us that comfort. We can change the land and conform it to ourselves. We can furrow it and plant it. We can build cities and roads. The ocean defies us, refuses to remain still, and rolls past our flimsy ventures on its surface with infinite indifference. We might pollute it and destroy the life that has evolved within it, but we cannot destroy the ocean so completely as we might the land. The ocean is moved only by the wind, sun, and moon, also by the planet's spin. Yet some humans feel about the ocean as they do about their blood. They cherish the aloneness they find on the ocean, an inexplicable paradox of feeling so personally about the implacably insensible. Those who leave shore and sail out onto the ocean become free prisoners held to splinters of wood or metal in a seemingly limitless space, kin to families of seabirds that crowd onto passing logs, related also to fiery trails that cross night skies. They cling to their little boats for more than awareness they cannot walk on water or live long immersed in it. They design their vessels to be solid and seaworthy, familiar perspectives of angles and curves that enclose like wombs, each vessel a seed of human civilization. They might pretend that they are masters of their decks and of the planet, empowered over water and universe, but these are hollow lies amid surging mountains of water that rise and fall with the intensity of lungs and the power to crush boats and men into ocean dust. The presence of death is as close as skin. What the ocean might have seemed to earliest humans is not recorded. Our ancestors must have first approached the ocean as at present we move beyond Earth into space. The first voyages were probably short and timid trips for fish in relatively shallow waters on the lower lips of continents that are rich in sea life. While landsmen experimented with spears and axes for hunting land animals, peoples along ocean shores hollowed out logs and developed paddles and oars for velocity and direction, later sails, and they invented hooks, lines, and nets. Several thousand years later, ocean fishing from boats and decks remains one of the most dangerous methods of food gathering. In clear weather, and most often in foul, fishermen have for centuries gone out into the wild ocean in flimsy cockle shells. Life on fishing boats is hard, lean, and forthright, and the men and women who pull lines or pots or work nets are always close to injury or death. As fishing stocks diminish and regulations become more severe, boats and crews take greater risks that call for intensifying skill and courage. For all its modernization, ocean fishing is a primitive chase of hunter and hunted across a deadly wilderness. Almost everyone who chooses a livelihood on a boat accepts the probability that they will die in the water. Every year, fishing and seafaring communities mourn the loss of friends, neighbors, family members, and shipmates who die at sea. The bodies of some are recovered, but more disappear, and nothing else will be known of them or their vessels. Edward Hellberg and his son, also named Edward, were fishermen. Both were born and raised in Astoria and spent most of their lives on the decks of boats, and both died at sea. The elder Hellberg was lost with three others of his crew when the shark boat Republic disappeared in a storm in waters off the Columbia River Bar in February 1945. His son died in August 1986 when a large ship suddenly turned into the old and familiar trawler McKinley and cut it in half near Grays Harbor, a few miles north of where his father's boat sank. The younger Edward Hellberg started fishing when he was a boy sometime after his father's death. He worked on several fishing crews and owned a succession of boats, one of which sank in the Gulf of Mexico. Fathers and sons, sometimes mothers and daughters, worked aboard decks with him. He was a man skippers never had to tell what to do. Two of his daughters, who worked as waitresses at a riverside restaurant, always watched for his boat, going downriver, to the ocean, or returning. He waved at them during daylight and flashed a boat light at the restaurant windows at night. When the McKinley was struck, he saved a shipmate from drowning in the forecastle. He died because he was in the cold water too long. His shipmates were younger and less affected by hypothermia and survived. It is not difficult to imagine how they felt, left alone in a cold and dark ocean, abandoned by the ship that ran them down. When a Coast Guard helicopter found them, they had been in the water almost an hour, clinging to a life ring. They scrambled for a wire basket the helicopter dropped, but Eddie could not hold on and fell back into the water. Many who attended his memorial service in Astoria, which has lost hundreds of its citizens to the ocean, have mourned dead parents, children, friends, and lovers who died with their vessels, and his fellow fishermen who came to say goodbye were aware they might also lose boats and perhaps their lives. After his death, one of his granddaughters, who was 4 years old then, got through the painful ordeal of his loss by imagining she was holding her grandfather's hand. A most important rule of ocean voyages is looking out for other vessels, of keeping a good watch not only for the protection of one's own craft, but for any that might be in danger. Ships and crews must also respond to the distress of other ships or search the ocean for survivors of sunken vessels. Coastal waters are particularly dangerous because of the large numbers of small craft that are continually run over by large ships that rely ever more on mechanical devices rather than human eyesight. A number of questions about the sinking of the McKinley remain. Two are primary. Why a good watch was not kept to prevent collision, and why the ship did not stop to rescue or drop a lifeboat to rescue McKinley's crew. The answers will not resurrect the highly regarded McKinley, nor return life to the good and decent man, Eddie Hellberg. But on the ocean, and soon in outer space, the human beings who venture out from shore and planet must be responsible for each other, or they will likely die. And that was The Price of Fish, which I wrote and have read on this program more than once at this time of year. And speaking of this time of year, I took a quote last year on this very same day, the 25th of February, except it was a Wednesday. And I'll read what I wrote that day. I just scribbled it down. All this talk about preserving Astoria's heritage is like dressing up a corpse, David Densmore said on KMUN. What he meant is that everything that made the Lower Columbia River vibrant is gone. The fishing and river culture, the wharves and shipping, the fish canneries, the log ships. And that was a quote from David Densmore of exactly 1 year ago on this station. I'd like to read now something that John Paul Barrett wrote for one of his two books, Sea Stories, and this is from book two. Barrett died in Belize, Mexico, about 3 months ago now. This is the yarn of the Nurka, and by the way, I knew Barrett for a long time also. We worked for a newspaper down in Long Beach, California, back in 1969. And he came up here, oh, about 2 years after I did, in 1971. The Yarn of the Nurka by John Paul Barrett. Nurka, a strange name. I had no idea what that word on the elderly vessel's bows meant. At first, I thought it might have been a Scandinavian fisherman's wife or girlfriend. Later, I learned it was a Native American name for the sockeye salmon, which had been incorporated into the Latin scientific tongue twister Ornconilinchus nurka, if I pronounced that correctly. She was a forlorn and forsaken old girl, obviously mistreated, and each of her many miles and decades at sea showed like the lines of an ancient lady's face. I recall looking at the sun-bleached and dog-eared for sale sign in her tiny wheelhouse window, then rapping on the hull with my fist, kicking the tires, you might say. Solid was my impression. Someone had built this vessel to last, and she had, but she looked bad. She appeared to have fallen from grace with the sea, but I was certain that I had not, and I could still see the beauty she had once enjoyed. I had contacted the owner and made arrangements to purchase the Nurka with a small, borrowed down payment, a handshake, and a mutually hopeful expectation that I would eventually catch enough fish to pay the boat off. It was not a difficult deal to make. Both parties were highly motivated. The Nurka had been for sale a long time, and I wanted a boat so badly that I would probably have made almost any deal. It is considered by many seamen to be bad luck to change the name of a boat. So, though tempted, I resisted, and in time grew to like the unusual name despite the fact that sockeye salmon were not native to the Columbia River area where I would fish. No point, I thought, in tempting fate. Such a precarious undertaking did not need any bad luck, particularly when good luck would be an absolute prerequisite for even a small measure of success. The once fair Nurka had, judging from a half-inch chip of paint I examined, over the 75-odd years of her existence, been painted every conceivable color of the spectrum. Layering indicated she had seldom worn the same color twice. Green seemed to have been at least part of the original color, and its popularity had apparently resurfaced every 10 years or so since her birth in 1902. Her cabin and hull were now white, the decks an ugly reddish-brown. The job had been sloppy and had not been improved by age. I deduced from trying to stand in her wheelhouse that the Nurka had been built to the precise personal measurements of a person no taller than 5 feet, 7 inches, 4 inches less than my height. There was no seat for the helmsman in this minuscule space. It was excruciatingly painful to hunch there for more than a few minutes. So after my first six-hour trip across the Columbia River bar and back, I fashioned what was probably the tiniest seat ever built. It allowed me to sit in a fixed position after some maneuvering halfway, one cheek at a time. It was just barely better than standing. After 2 hours in this position, I began to feel like an 18th century Chinese beggar's child who had been raised in an urn to ensure pitiful deformity. The cabin was not quite 3 feet across and even smaller fore and aft. Adding yet further discomfort, the asbestos-wrapped exhaust stack ran straight up the aft bulkhead, directly behind and actually touching the back of the unfortunate helmsman. This stack became quite hot after a few minutes with the engine running, which necessitated opening at least one of the Lilliputian windows, which resulted in the freezing of the front part of my body while my backside baked. The stack got so hot sometimes that the wooden bulkhead behind it would begin to smolder, threatening to catch fire. Once in desperation, I extinguished the fire using the only liquid I had at hand, coffee. I filled my mouth with coffee and sprayed the burning spot. Of course, the spray hit the stack pipe as well, which filled the cabin with billows of coffee-flavored steam, along with the smoke. Since I couldn't leave the helm in rough water, where the automatic pilot wouldn't hold a course, I was stuck there, trying to steer, whilst poking my nose out the window. Pardon me, a page stuck. I quickly learned to reserve at least one mouthful of some kind of liquid for firefighting purposes. Although I did store, the Coast Guard required 2 fire extinguishers aboard. They were expensive to refill and were to be used only when absolutely necessary. Thus, the common emergencies, and that's in quotes, which took place aboard NERCA were categorized according to their level of danger, and my responses to them varied according to their size. Why waste a good fire extinguisher charge if it wasn't necessary? The coffee spray method worked until I got around to repairing the damage to the stack insulation. The bulkhead had been thoroughly blackened over the years, indicating to me that this problem was not new and that it had probably been dealt with by NERCA's who knows how many previous masters in a similar manner. I wondered how many mouthfuls of coffee, tea, whiskey, or water had been spat on the smoking stack over the years. The NERCA's cabin and foredecks leaked worse than her white cedar hull, more of a nuisance than a danger, but nevertheless a big problem, since the Arbol adhesive and burlap, they should have used canvas, patch job had worn out long ago and needed replacing. There was no chance of patching the deck in the traditional or correct manner, with new planking, etc. Such an undertaking would have been prohibitively expensive, and since I was operating on a broken and tied shoestring budget, everything had to be done in the cheapest way possible. A much more dangerous way to do business than I realized at the time. I also soon learned not to start digging with my knife anywhere on the boat in an effort to locate rot. It was everywhere, except below the waterline, where there was surprisingly little. The best I could do topside was to use the existing structure as a base for reinforcing additions. Because of the meticulous care and skill with which the boat's timbers, joists, thwarts, ribs, etc., had been fitted together, a little shallow dry rot didn't seem to affect overall structural stability noticeably. So long as there was still some portion of solid wood involved, the whole thing hung together, sometimes apparently even defying gravity and the laws of physics. One day I noticed that a small sliver of wood had fallen from the bottom part of the mainmast, just above the base or step. I located the spot where the piece had been and scraped around the area with my knife. The deeper I went, the more rot I found. I couldn't stop digging. Then I tried pushing the knife straight in. It went in past the hilt and came out the other side. The mast was rotten. This discovery not only represented a major setback, but sent a shiver up my spine. I had been to sea several times with it in that condition, and each of the many pieces of running and standing rigging, trolling poles, fore and aft, guys, stays, etc., were all attached to this key part of the vessel. The mast would have to be replaced, which meant undoing the spiderweb of wires, turnbuckles, lines, shackles, and whatnot, a mind-boggling task as it appeared to me at the time. Later, after more digging, I could see that the whole thing was not rotten. Only the bottom 3 feet had been ravaged. Miraculously, the rest was sound. I finally repaired the mast by amputating the rotten portion and shaping the stump to fit into a piece of 5-inch double-strength black iron pipe 4 feet long. The mast was rock solid, or so I thought for nearly a year. The Nerka initially had bow poles, which were mounted on a foremast on the forecastle in addition to the two main trolling poles, each the length of the boat amidships. It was a fairly common rig in Alaska's relatively calm inside waters, but unusual in Oregon. The bow poles and mast came down violently one day while crossing a rough bar. I left them off in flavor of float bags, and that's a quote, which are devices dragged behind the boat. The idea with floats is to separate each individual trolling wire from the others as much as possible to avoid tangling, which can easily happen in the powerful currents off the Columbia River, where the water may be moving in one direction on the surface, another 3 fathoms down, and yet another near the bottom. Nevertheless, a few times I actually managed to get all 4 lines tangled together, a horrible nightmarish mess of expensive lures, wire, hooks, all twisted and kinked under the boat. I can blame a large shark for doing this a couple of times, but the rest were my own fault for getting in too shallow, letting out too much wire, turning too quickly, or making one or more of several other kinds of mistakes. When this happens, one must untangle piece by piece each individual part of the gear while simultaneously trying to steer clear of other vessels and obstacles, and it can result in the loss of hundreds of dollars worth of equipment. The trolling wires are held down by lead cannonballs, weighing up to 90 pounds or more. At about 50 cents a pound at the time, the loss of one of these was major. Most trollers I've known have left hundreds of pounds of lead on the bottoms of their fishing grounds. A guy could make a fortune with a lead magnet out there, goes the joke. I made a significant contribution to the lead content of the waters off Oregon and Washington, eventually regarding the loss as a kind of fine for ineptitude, the price of learning what not to do. At the business end of the Nerka was the cockpit, a small opening in the deck at the stern, inside which I would half sit when running the lines. I spent countless hours in this tiny spot, usually in abject boredom, but once in a while, not often enough, it became the center of intense excitement when fish hit. The cockpit not only served as a spot from which to work the gear, it was also the only place where one could gain access to the rudder post and steering mechanism, called the quadrant. The rudder was attached to a steel shaft, which ran up through a pipe, capped at the top, containing grease and packing. This is an extremely important part of any vessel so constructed, and, as I learned several times firsthand, both in the Nerka and aboard other boats, when the packing wears out, the rudder post leaks, but only when the boat is underway. This makes it nearly impossible to determine where a leak is coming from while parked at the dock. The steering quadrant mechanism was a marvel of ingenuity, as were many things in the Nerka. But by the time I became involved with her, most things had been Mickey Moused, jury-rigged, neglected, or just ignored. The steering setup was one of these. For some reason, I assume, one having to do with a combination of poverty, ignorance, and perhaps desperation, what should have been steering quadrant chain, a type of flat-linked chain designed specifically for use in boat steering rigs, had been replaced with insulated cable. The thick plastic insulation had worn away, creating large globs of plastic at the openings of the various pulleys, all of which impeded smooth operation of the works. The cable had also kinked in several places and would bind in the rollers of the worn pulleys, which caused the rudder to become stuck in one position. After the first time this intolerable situation occurred, I replaced the cable with chain, refastened the pulleys, greased the whole mess thoroughly, finally got everything working as it had been intended, and proceeded to the next problem. the next problem, and the one which continued through my 7-year association with the boat, as well as the one which contributed substantially to her ultimate demise, was the leaking hull. I could write an entire section on the subject of bilge pumps and my many adventures in trying to keep water outside the hull, then removing it from inside when that wasn't possible. It was a constant worry. I even dreamed about it. I still wonder where some of Nerka's phantom leaks were. Some only happened when the boat was underway, some only at the dock, and at times it seemed some unknown adversary had poured water into the boat when I wasn't looking. I had the boat hauled out on the waves several times during my ownership, replacing planks, caulking, painting, padding, and packing her bottom, everything I could think of, and when she was back in the water, she still leaked. I was ready to try voodoo, offerings to the gods, chanting, anything. I even attempted a curious but strangely logical-sounding method once related to me in a tavern. "What you do, see," my drinking companion told me cryptically, "is get yourself about 10 pounds of sawdust and a broom." The fellow went on to say one should take the sawdust and broom down to the boat at low or high slack water, then dump a pound or so of sawdust into the water next to the boat. "Then you kind of push the sawdust down into the water along the hull," he said, "and it works just like stop leak in a radiator, only in reverse." Theoretically, the sawdust would be drawn into the places where the boat was leaking. It would then swell from being wet and would effectively recaulk the boat. The process was to be done at slack water. "So don't wash all your sawdust away." Real simple. I actually tried it, and it worked, I think, sort of. The success of such a thing is difficult to determine on a boat while it is working. Leaks in an old boat are something with which one learns to coexist. The jury-rig job I had done on the mast was apparently solid, but months later, after repeatedly taking slack out of the starboard main mast guy wire, I determined that the key 5-inch by 8-inch cedar thwartship beam supporting the mast and its steps beneath the deck had a 6-foot lengthways crack. It was allowing the entire mast and pole suspension assembly to wag and pop almost imperceptibly, yet nonetheless dangerously when the boat was underway. Of course, I fixed that problem also as soon as I was aware of it, but until that time I had felt a sense of satisfaction with the fine job I'd done on the mast every time I looked at it, blissfully ignorant that the whole mess still rested on a foundation of little more than an expectation. And yet the little boat did hold together with a lick and a promise for another 6 years, and somehow managed to bring me back to the dock safely hundreds of times, though a few of those times were not under her own power. Perhaps the boat had developed a benevolent relationship with the ocean. Perhaps, as it is said, fools, drunks, and children are protected. She sank at the dock in 1980, was refloated twice after that, but never recovered enough to return to the ocean. One day she was hauled onto a deserted bank of the Skipanon River and was set ablaze. I was not present for this event, and I have not visited the site of the cremation. There would be too many unburned reminders. I prefer to think of the Nerka underway at sea, bucking a westerly swell under my feet. That is how she still lives in my dreams, even today. And that was The Saga of the Nerka by John Paul Barrett. And it's from the second of two sea stories book he not only wrote, but self-published. This is Michael McCusker.